Tell me what you're feeling right now, Matt.
Honestly, I'm just feeling a little worried that I'm not going to come across as well as you want me to on the video or on this podcast.
I'm talking with Matt Mort. I invited him over to Media Lab without telling him exactly why. What do you see on screen right now?
My trip to New York City, part four. I get Patty LuPone'd.
Not precisely hard-hitting journalism. I'm having him watch a video I made over 10 years ago, which I then posted to YouTube. This was a time when YouTube was not like it is now. Very few people were uploading to the site, and I had just come back from a trip to New York. I took a mini DV camera, which meant I was recording directly to some videotapes. I also thought I was being classy by using a handheld microphone I happened to have. But this video was created after a very long day.
But you chose to lay down for the video?
Yeah, I made a bold choice where I would lay down on my bed and have my friend Jamie hold the camera while I recorded the video.
I thought it was on a tripod.
It is not.
Okay.
It is my friend holding it. I also should say, too, that I was exceptionally tired at this point.
Yeah, like you mentioned that.
We had probably been up for like 18 hours or something and walked like 5 or 6 miles that day. Like, I was really dead.
Yeah, you said in the beginning of the video that you're really tired.
So the reason I'm making Matt watch this is because I recorded this video right after watching Patty LuPone star in Gypsy. Hence, why it makes sense to even do this on this podcast. Do you know who Patty LuPone is?
Nope.
Want to take a guess?
Is she in Cats?
No.
That's the only musical.
Yeah, that's the only musical you know? Yeah.
And Frozen.
Who stars in Cats? What are the characters in Cats?
The characters or the actors?
No, the characters. Name me one character from Cats.
Lightning McQueen.
Yeah, that's one. I intentionally did not rewatch this terrible video I made a decade ago because I wanted to stay pure. Little did I know that I barely even talk about the performance. I spent more time discussing the theater etiquette of the people around me that I had found less than desirable. But ultimately, I wanted to figure out if Matt would want to watch Gypsy after this video. But what actually happened was that it was just mortifying to watch again.
Oh, you're doing the showstopper from Gypsy. Oh, fuck. Oh, you're singing.
Goodness. Oh, my goodness.
You'll be swell.
I'm retro.
Whoa! No way! That was cool. You said, you'll be swell, you'll be great. And then I was basically the cameraman because you looked to the guy behind the camera and said, what? As if he was cringing too. So everyone was cringing.
This is probably the start of me not wanting to sing on this podcast. Blame Gypsy, everyone. So yeah, this is the very final message in this video.
Yes, with some beautiful music in the background. You said, I heart you, Patty. Don't ever change, like a yearbook. Like that's what
that's right. They signed your digital yearbook.
Yeah.
So after that entire video, if you had to guess, what's Gypsy about?
Yeah, the only word I heard was roses. Uh-huh. So I don't know what it's about.
But if you had to guess.
If I had to guess that it's about a crystal ball and getting your future told by Sinbad.
Good, great. Well, my name is Kyle Marshall from Media Lab YYC in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. This is Putting It Together, the podcast that discusses Stephen Sondheim's entire body of work chronologically, show by show, and song by song. We've arrived at Gypsy. We have a long episode this week, so I'm going to save the history of Gypsy for next time. I hope everyone had an incredible Christmas, or whatever it is that you celebrate. I'm really happy to be back in this chair talking about one of my favorite things, you know, besides Whiskers on Kittens. I want to say right off the top that I feel so grateful to have the audience that is building up around this podcast. There are passionate and engaged fans of musical theater in general and Stephen Sondheim in particular. I created a survey that I mentioned in the last two episodes of our West Side Story season. I want you to know that I've taken the feedback you left to heart and am changing some of the things you said that I should. Namely, I'm going to include a few more musical selections, still being aware of copyright infringement, and I'm not going to mention the book of lyrics or the shows that we are drawing inspiration from on every single episode. Instead, I'll leave that in the show notes for people to discover on their own. Your feedback is incredibly important, and it's something I'm going to ask for at the end of each season so that we can have the best possible podcast. So I've been a Stephen Sondheim fan for so many years, but by doing this show, I've become even more so, I think. The great guests who approach me to be on it is humbling for me, and that's no exception this week. Now, eagle-eyed listeners, that's a mixed metaphor, but people who've been paying attention may think that today we have a repeat guest. I had a William White on last season to discuss One Hand, One Heart. However, that is not the same William White who I spoke to for this episode. But we'll get to those shenanigans in a few minutes. Just know that this William White is a phenomenal composer and educator. He was incredibly engaging to talk with and was able to teach me a few things about Stephen Sondheim, Julie Stein, and vaudeville. However, before we get too far into the show, I should mention that Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. They promote and support Alberta-made podcasts and connect their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. You can find us and all the great shows at albertapodcastnetwork.com. Our first sponsor is Let's Do Coffee. This is another podcast which is presented by the Maji Center for New Venture and Student Entrepreneurship. That's part of NATE, the Northern Alberta Institute for Technology. Each episode dives into topics that explore the challenges, questions, and fears each individual has or had when operating their companies. In the latest episode, there is a great conversation with a serial entrepreneur, freshly graduated student, and all-around interesting guy, Carter Buchanan. You get to learn about Carter's four businesses, burning out, time management, and how shallow Instagram is. How dare you hate on the gram? In all seriousness, this is a great show, especially for the entrepreneurs out there. You can find episodes to download by following the link in the show notes or by remembering letsdocoffee.libsyn.com. Our other sponsor this week is ATB. And yes, ATB is a bank and I talk about it fairly often. But if you want to give back to a charity that you love, you should think about ATB Cares. By using that website, you can give to your favorite charity and have ATB give an additional 15% on top of that donation. It's really a win-win for you and the causes that matter the most to your own life and to your community. I have no funny joke here. I just think that that's pretty cool. You can visit atbcares.com for more information. Thanks to our sponsors. Take a look at the show notes for information about the music we're referencing and how to get your own book of Sondheim lyrics. We'll jump into my conversation with William C. White right after we listen to a few selections from various versions of the overture and May We Entertain You from the musical Gypsy. Will White, thank you so much for joining me.
It is my absolute and distinct pleasure to be with you, Kyle.
We have to nip this right in the bud, right here at the very beginning. Your name is Will White. You're actually the second Will White to be on this show, but you are not the same Will White as before.
Yes, this is this. I mean, the first when I opened up the podcast with the first William White on there and I saw my name, I was like, wait a second. I know I listened to this podcast, but I didn't know I was on it.
Some weird vortex you were sucked into and recorded without anybody actually knowing that you were on. Why don't we start here, though? Can you maybe introduce yourself and let people know what it is that you do?
Sure. So I am William White or A. William White. Oftentimes I go by William C. White. I'm a composer and a conductor. Primarily, of classical music. I work with orchestras and choruses. I actually have a group here where I live in Seattle, Washington, called Orchestra Seattle, which is works in concert with a group called the Seattle Chamber Singers. So we're sort of like an oratorio society. But in my past life, I was the assistant conductor of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. I have done a lot of musical theater, including many shows by Sondheim and by Bernstein. And, you know, I just love it. I mean, it's to me, it's all sort of one big thing. And Stephen Sondheim is really my favorite living composer in any genre. So, you know, when I found this podcast, it just really hit a nerve. And I've been a fan ever since.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I guess, is there a specific moment that you can recall where you were like, oh, like composing and creating music is the path that I want to pursue?
It really became clear to me when I was in high school. I was composing before I was conducting. I mean, I was writing little pieces for piano and maybe for little chamber ensembles. And then I was playing viola in our high school orchestra. And, you know, because I was in the orchestra, I just sort of fell in love with orchestral music. And I started writing orchestral music. And, you know, lo and behold, it turned out that people weren't like lining up to conduct the music written by random 15-year-old students. And so it, you know, if I found out that if I wanted to have my music played, I was going to have to conduct it. So that was my entree. And then my first big opportunities as a conductor were actually in the pit. I got to conduct my high school's musicals. I started with Cabaret, and then I did Kiss Me, Kate. And then there was this amazing youth theater outside of Washington, D.C., where I'm from, called Wildwood Summer Theater. And we have a lot of wonderful alumni who have gone on to big careers in Broadway. But the cool thing about it was that everybody in this program was between the ages of 14 and 25. And that was down to the music director and the conductor and the board of directors and the publicity department and just everything. So, you know, you really got this amazing opportunity for leadership if you wanted it. And in that group, I sort of worked my way up from playing in the pit to becoming a chorus director to becoming the music director and conductor. And when I was 18, I conducted West Side Story, my first production of that show, with a full orchestra, you know, full production. Full staging and cast. So it was in those teenage years that it just, my path was set, and musical theater was a big part of that.
Where did Sondheim come into that equation? Was that something you were listening to while in high school, or was that something you were introduced to after?
It came in a little bit later. It wasn't until I was in college that I got into Sondheim. I had a little bit of a misconception about Sondheim when I was in high school from all of these, you know, high school music theater kids that I was friends with. And they would talk about, you know, Sondheim this, Sondheim that, but it was in conversation with the other sort of popular musical theater composers of the day, like, for example, Jonathan Larson and Claude Michel Schoenberg, you know, that they were into Sondheim because they were into other theater music. And I really, you know, what I knew of, like, say, Rent or Les Mis, I did not care for. I found it very schlocky. I still do. And, you know, it was sort of poppy and rocky. And I sort of lumped Sondheim in with those people because, you know, that's what those kids, those theater kids were talking about. Then I went to see and heard a production of Into the Woods when I was maybe a freshman in college. And I was like, whoa, this is not what I expected it to be. And then I music directed a production of Company, and I was totally sold. And, you know, it's just like, you know, Sondheim is really the descendant, as far as I'm concerned, of the classical composers who I was really into. You know, I liked musical theater when I liked the music. Like, for example, you know, West Side Story of Leonard Bernstein. So then when I found out that Sondheim's music really had more to do with Ravel and Rachmaninoff and Stravinsky, rather than, you know, like Elton John or somebody, you know, who would be more akin to some of those popular music theater composers, then I was off to the races, and Sondheim quickly became one of my favorite all-time composers.
It's going to be hard to frame this because we're talking about Gypsy here now, and we're still not yet to a Sondheim show where he's written the music as well as the lyrics. However, you're going to probably be the best person I can ask this to right now. What musical composers do you think Sondheim draws the most inspiration from in his own music writing?
Oh, in terms of other composers of Broadway shows?
No, I mean like classical composers.
Oh, classical composers? Well, you know, it's funny. Just this past weekend, I was conducting a concert here in Seattle, and we were doing Maurice Ravel's Piano Concerto for the Left Hand. And I would really recommend that piece to any fans of Sondheim, particularly of Into the Woods. I know people who have heard that piece the first time without knowing what it was, who thought that it was a fantasia on themes of Into the Woods arranged for piano and orchestra. And in fact, it is a piece that Stephen Sondheim wrote his college senior thesis on. So, I mean, you know, Sondheim loves Ravel. And I think that you hear a lot of Ravel, especially Into the Woods, and not just in the main tune, but also in the jazzier numbers like the Wolf's numbers, I think have a lot to do with Ravel. I think that you definitely hear, well, and Sondheim talks a lot about his love for Bernard Herrmann, who is not exactly a classical composer, but, you know, was a major film score composer of the early and middle 20th century, wrote the scores for Hitchcock's films. You know, I think that he credits Herrmann with influencing especially Sweeney Todd.
I can hear that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, all of those dark colors and chords and of course it's reflected in the orchestration by Jonathan Tunick. But you know, I know that Sondheim also loves Rachmaninoff. I think that the way that he colors a melody and stretches it out, I know that he loves Brahms, although I don't quite hear Brahms as much in his music. But you know, Sondheim is a real, he's a polymath, and there's a lot of influences there. But I think that in terms of the classical composers, Ravel is probably the strongest influence.
Hmm. You mentioned how you had the opportunity to go like from the pit into a more leadership or like teacher type of position. What do you receive in a teaching role that you don't get as a performer?
Oh, well, I mean, when I am teaching, I feel that I'm really at my best. And I would say that as a conductor, one is always teaching. I mean, being a conductor is in essence being a teacher who sort of also happens to lead a group through dance. So yeah, I mean, that opportunity to pass along knowledge and to see people encounter a work or an idea for the first time is essential to everything that I've done. I mean, I was the conductor of the Cincinnati Symphony Youth Orchestra for 4 years. I was a conductor of a youth orchestra in Portland, Oregon before I moved up here. I'm frequently a high school and college clinician. So, you know, I work with young people a lot, and it's so meaningful for me. And I know that you've talked on the podcast a lot about how Sondheim himself is a great representative of this idea of channeling knowledge through the generations. I mean, he's a really dedicated teacher, and he, you know, shows up for all of these rehearsals and productions of his music or of his shows to you know, teach and propagate. And he thinks of teaching as being the holiest profession. And of course, it really is.
Well, that's great to hear. I will one day make my way close so I can actually see something that you are performing. But alas, we are many, many thousands of miles away from each other. What can you tell me? Because this is the first episode of what I'm dubbing the second season of this show, even though we only took like a couple week break here. We know that Sondheim, again, is writing the lyrics to Gypsy, but that Julie Stein is really the person behind the music. What can you tell me about Julie Stein?
Well, Julie Stein, I mean, is definitely coming from an earlier generation. You know, I mean, he was, I think, maybe sort of ended up being the fourth person asked to write this score after, let's see, who was it? Cole Porter and maybe Irving Berlin. And then Sondheim, of course, was asked, but was then refused by Ethel Merman. And so then Julie Stein took it on. But Julie Stein was part of that older generation. You know, I think he was roughly contemporaneous with Cole Porter. So I think that he was, you know, brought up in more of the world of Gypsy, you know, where composers were churning out melodies, sort of Tin Pan Alley tunes. I don't know that he was ever actually a Tin Pan Alley tunesmith, but you know, that was more the aesthetic, was like that tunes were sort of a dime a dozen and you churn them out and somebody wrote lyrics to them and you wanted them to be as generic as possible so that they could be sung by a man or a woman and they could become hit in terms of selling sheet music and in getting played on the radio and getting covered by like dance bands and other popular singers. Whereas Sondheim, you know, is bringing something quite different to this show. I mean, his one Broadway credit, which was West Side Story, where he worked with all of these sort of highfalutin, high art people. I mean, from, you know, Leonard Bernstein, who then became the music director of the New York Philharmonic, to Jerome Robbins, who was like bringing in modern dance and ballet into the American musical theater. So it's an interesting combination. I mean, I don't know too much about the specifics of Julie Stein's biography, but I know that, you know, he was definitely approaching this project from a slightly different perspective than Sondheim was.
Yeah, they mention a lot in Sondheim's book, Finishing the Hat, that they really were a generation apart, that they worked well with each other, but just the way that they worked and what they thought of music as almost was just completely separated by this generational difference in their ages.
Right, because Julie Stein showed up. I mean, I think the first time that they were talking about the collaboration, Julie Stein said, okay, well, he's handing him a sheet of music and was like, well, here's a bunch of tunes that you can use. Just write words to these. And Sondheim was like, yeah, you know, maybe we should start from scratch. Maybe we should, you know, go for something more organic, where the music itself actually has a, you know, it's more tied to the plot and the themes, and it's more a whole package rather than just, you know, a collection of songs, which is something that they would have done in those, you know, 1930s shows of Cole Porter, say.
I now, weirdly enough, want to go into the alternate timeline where it was Gypsy written by Cole Porter. That would just been a completely different show.
Well, you know, my big question about this, and I got to be in Stephen Sondheim's presence one time when I was in graduate school. I was getting my master's degree in orchestral conducting.
You weren't hiding out in the bushes, ready to jump on him.
Well, I was, to tell you the truth. But I mean, so like, you know, he came to Indiana University where I was studying, and he held a Q&A. For students, but it was really for students of the theater department. And, you know, I was not going to let this opportunity pass me by. So I somehow, you know, wormed my way into this. And so it was, you know, probably, I don't know, maybe 50 students or something. And Sondheim was on the stage and he did a little, you know, Q&A with like a host, and then students got to ask him questions. And I did get to ask him a question, and it was about the orchestrators that he had worked with. But if I had it all to do over again, the question that I would have asked Sondheim is, you know, when you were writing Gypsy, you, in many cases, were writing the lyrics and Julie Stein was setting those lyrics to music. Whereas with Bernstein, with West Side Story, that really was a lot of pre-existing music and Sondheim was just writing the lyrics to fit in there. So my question is, when he was writing the lyrics, you know, outside of pre-existing music for Gypsy, did he imagine his own music? You know, did he have tunes in his mind for some of these songs? Is there an alternate score of Gypsy that only lives inside the mind of Stephen Sondheim that none of us will ever get to hear? That's something I'm tremendously curious about.
Yeah, that would, I mean, I guess that you could say the same thing for certain songs in West Side Story as well.
Right.
There was a couple, at least, that he wrote before they set to music. A lot of them, though, music came first, and there was some collaboration that went back and forth. But yeah, what would the show have been like had Sondheim been able to write both music and lyrics? Like, how much different would it be? Or would there be some similarities that still would sneak in?
Yeah, well, we'll never know.
We'll never know. I found it because as you were talking about this difference in styles between Julie Stein and Sondheim, I remember this quote that he wrote down and I had to find the page it was on. But he says that Julie Stein and I were not only a generation apart, we were different species, coming as we did from different musical theater traditions. He, the spontaneous tunesmith, as he called himself, and I, the austere revolutionary.
But of course, in reality, they were both writing show tunes for Broadway musical theater. I mean, you know, sure, within a small spectrum, they were on opposite sides of it. But, you know, they were essentially doing the same thing.
Well, let's segue here into talk about a couple of the songs here from the show. Whereas Gypsy is often referred to as one of the best pieces of musical theater ever written. And definitely I've seen it in countless different reviews and histories of Broadway, how the book especially is considered one of the best books of a musical ever written. It starts off fairly standard, where we have an overture that opens up the show, and then we kind of have this song that introduces a little bit into the world. Before we get to that, let's talk about overtures in general terms, because this is something like, I would say, TV theme songs, right? There used to be the heyday of the TV theme song, where sometimes it would go on for like a couple minutes, or at least it seemed like it was. And now you're kind of lucky if you just get like a sound to introduce us to the fact that we're watching this show. And overtures used to be like you just had an overture and then it went into the show afterwards. Do you have any sense about what the purpose of the overtures traditionally were for?
Well, I mean, in the most practical sense, they serve a purpose of just delaying the beginning of the show for latecomers, you know. But in another sense, I mean, they really do set the mood and they introduce some of the themes. I mean, you know, the typical Broadway overture is a medley of tunes from the show. And it allows the orchestra to sort of get warmed up and to bring the audience into the sound world of the show. I talk to performers a lot of the time, and performers love it when a musical has an overture, because it's like they're down in their dressing rooms and it gets them really pumped up. You know, it gets them excited for the beginning of the show. It's funny. Overtures are almost always written last. And that goes back to the days of the Baroque and classical eras. I mean, Mozart, I think, for example, wrote all of his overtures last. Now, those overtures, they were a little bit different in the classical era. They usually were not that sort of medley. Like if you listen to the overture to The Marriage of Figaro, that sets the mood for the show that's about to come, but it does not include any musical references to music that happens later in the show. But, you know, another thing that was that's interesting about writing these overtures for Broadway is that the orchestrators were the ones who usually assembled the overture. It very rarely was it the composer, him or herself, who writes the overture. It's sort of farmed out. It's a separate task. And yet, you know, it really can't be done until all of the tunes are written. And you see how things can flow into each, flow from one tune into another. But, I love it when a musical has an overture. West Side Story, of course, did not have an overture. I mean, that's one of the first ones that really does not. There was an overture written for West Side Story, but it was discarded. I think they used it for maybe a week or something. Then they thought, yeah, you know, we don't need an overture. We want to establish a whole different kind of mood and a whole different tenor to this show.
Yeah, they instead go with what they call the prologue, which is just a bunch of like vocalizations and soundscapes and stuff like that, but nothing like that standard overture. In fact, I was actually thinking about this here this week as I was preparing for this episode. How many Sondheim shows actually have an overture? I can't think of any besides this one.
I think Forum has one. And
Forum might. Yeah, yeah.
And anyone can whistle. I don't know if that has one. Depending on what you count as a Sondheim show, I mean, I think Do I Hear a Waltz probably has one. But certainly, you know, Company doesn't have one. Follies has an overture. Follies does have an overture.
Sure, but not many of them. I guess my question here is then whether we want to compare this with other Sondheim overtures or just other musical theater overtures, how does this compare to other musical theater overtures, the one in Gypsy specifically?
Well, Gypsy is often considered the greatest overture written in the musical theater. And that, you know, the only one that people will compare it to is Porgy and Bess, for those who consider that a musical. And even that is not exactly an overture. And the distinction here is that an overture has a definite ending to it. Whereas Porgy and Bess is more of a prelude because it segs directly into summertime.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, and you can look at this in the history of opera as well. There are certain opening instrumental pieces that are called overtures and certain that are called preludes. An overture is one that has a definite ending and that is applauded before the main action happens, whereas a prelude just leads right into it. This overture is considered so spectacular, really largely for the orchestration. There are bits of it, it's so brassy and bold, and the tunes are so great, but really, like, you know, you've got these wild brass going crazy down there. I mean, these orchestrators, you know, they thought that the average Broadway pit at this point had maybe a couple of trumpets, but they got three trumpets and three trombones.
Yeah, you can tell that right from the very beginning. Like, it opens up loud, right? Like, it's just like, boom, we are starting this show with this full, like, brass section behind us.
Right, right. And, you know, it was orchestrated by Sid Raymond and Red Gensler. And Gensler in particular, he's an interesting guy. He was a trombonist. And in fact, he has a Canadian connection. He was the principal trombonist of the Toronto Symphony when he was like 19 years old. And so, but he was doing classical and big band jazz at the same time. Like, I think that he was roommates with Bix Beiderbecke at one point, and he was when the war started, he had to leave Canada, and so he moved back to New York, and there he was going to, like, you know, listen to these early swing ensembles and going to, you know, Harlem kind of dance clubs and hearing the big bands. And, you know, I mean, just with his heavy brass background, I mean, that it totally infuses this score. And the excitement that you get from this overture is just phenomenal because of that big band swing era kind of sound.
Yeah. Bix Beiderbecke is a name that sounds like Dr. Seuss made it up, but it's just fun to say. I want to highlight the few songs that it definitely references inside the overture. And forgive me, I might have missed one here or there, but as far as I can tell with my ear, it goes from Everything's Coming Up Roses.
Yeah.
You'll Never Get Away From Me. Mm-hmm. Small World. May We Entertain You. And then ends with Mr. Goldstone.
Right. And, you know, I did a little reading up on this. There's a great book for anybody who's interested in orchestration, Broadway orchestration, and just in, like, what that means and how it's done and, like, who were some of the really interesting figures who played a pivotal role in the history of that sound. There is this book by a writer named Susskind called The Sound of Broadway Music. And it's really interesting. And it's got a listing of basically every musical from the golden era of Broadway musicals. And it talks about, like, who was the orchestrator and what was their background and stuff like that. But there's a very extensive passage about the Gypsy Overture. And he mentions that there is also some discarded music, like, because, you know, there were a bunch of these vaudeville tunes or songs, kind of pastiche songs, that were going to be included in the show that got cut later on. And some of that music, especially some of the wild brass stuff, is taken from some of that discarded material.
I can imagine that there is a bunch of different iterations on the way to, like, that finished product that you finally see. What I actually find the most interesting about this overture is that when you hear, like, a revival of any other show, certain songs may sound, like, slightly different based on, like, singer and maybe even, like, what instruments they decide to put in there. But, like, the melody at least is essentially the same. But there is a portion of May We Entertain You, specifically, that is very different in all three renditions that I listened to in preparation for this. Because I think what they did, or at least maybe after the original Broadway cast, they just told the trumpeters to be like, whatever you want to do, do it. Like, just improv these, like, whatever 16 bars or however long that little section is that they do in there, and just go for it. Because you have a pretty standard rendition inside the original Broadway cast. But then you get to the Bernadette Peters version in 2003, and they go nuts. uh, I'd actually, to tell you the truth, had actually not listened to the Bernadette Peters rendition or revival here until a couple weeks ago. And that was the first time I put it on. And I was actually listening to it as I was driving. And so I put on the overture. I'm driving. I'm like, I'm pretty sure I know what to expect with the overture. And then those horns hit in that section. And like, and I almost had to stop. I was like, yeah, like you go, guys. Like, that is amazing what you're doing right now with those trumpets. It actually very much does set the stage for how different Bernadette Peters' version of Gypsy is than anyone else's, really.
Yeah, and in the Angela Lansbury version in the London cast, there's some extra riffing in the trumpets. I don't know if that's the other version that you were going to talk about.
No, the other one is the Patti LuPone version.
On Broadway. That one's wild too.
But that one's wild too, in a very different way. Like, they don't go as like high pitched with it, but they still do a little bit of a improv section in that same bow. So I like how the fact that you can throw your own little flair onto it.
Yeah, they leave room for improvisation. And, you know, I should say, I have conducted this overture. I've never done the show, but you can do the overture in like a symphonic arrangement, you know, and I did it on a Pops concert at least once. And it is just so much fun. And if memory serves me, when it gets to that sort of breakout section, it is indicated in the trumpeter's parts that they should just improvise there.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you've got some real Waylon trumpets, I mean, it can just get so much fun.
I wonder how it was, I guess, approached at the time. Like, if I'm Broadway audience member in 1959 coming to see this new Ethel Merman show and like that overture hits for the very first time, I'm just very curious, like, what people were thinking before the curtain actually came up for act one. Like, were they were like, am I in the right theater? Or were they were like, yeah, we're pumped, let's do this?
Oh, I think it must have put a big smile on their face. Because, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, is it Sondheim who talks about how, like, you know, they were the two reigning divas of the Broadway theater at the time?
Yeah.
Were Ethel Merman and Mary Martin, mm-hmm. who could not have been more different.
Yeah, like,
and it's like that
polar opposites.
Overture, you know, and so he said that, like, you know, Gypsy was a really successful show that was not a smash hit. And he said that part of the reason was because some people stayed away because they thought Ethel Merman was too brash. But it's like, if you're going to this show and you know that Merman is in it and you're a Merman fan and that overture starts, like, that overture is like Ethel Merman in, you know, orchestrated. You
right,
know, I
right.
mean, it's like, I just think that people must have had a big smile on their face when that wild kind of burlesque music started. And it's just so much fun. And you get to hear these musicians really going crazy down there.
Yeah. Like, how can we make an orchestra but Mermanize it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
My big question actually is, why do you think they chose the songs that they did to highlight? And for me, at least, this is maybe my bias showing here more than anything, I'm just really interested that they chose to end with Mr. Goldstone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's how they end the overture to go into the show. Not that I want them to do like Rose's Turn or something like that, but it's just an interesting choice, I think, to pick from.
Yeah, I agree. It's a curious choice. And I really have no idea how they selected these particular numbers. And also, You Will Never Get Away From Me. You know, I mean, that's like, was it Sondheim who said that he thought that like Julie Stein thought that was going to be the hit tune, but Sondheim right. didn't really even care for it that much. or like somebody else had written some lyrics to it at some point and he never would have done it. You know, that, yeah, that's a strange choice to have in there. I don't know. I mean, you know, usually with these overtures, you know, you want to start with something bold and fun and upbeat, and then you want to go to something mellow. You know, there's usually like an ebb and flow so that the whole overture has a shape to it. So ending with the Mr. Goldstone, which is like, you know, they do it sort of like a jig. Mm-hmm. And you know, so it's like a quadrille almost. That you know, it ends with this kind of rambunctious little 6-8, dance. I mean, like, you know, there are worse ways that you could have ended the overture, but sure. I don't know. Yeah. It is a little surprising, the songs that they chose, but to me, you know, that just makes the overture all that much more, impressive, is that like, they didn't necessarily choose the most obvious, you know, hit tunes. And yet they made something that's so iconic out of it.
I just think it's a missed opportunity that they didn't end with Dainty June and her farm boys. I guess we'll have to wait to see that reimagining happen at some point in the future.
Yeah, right. Although I will say this is one show where, you know, the overture seems to stick with the show. You know, a lot of the times, I mean, orchestrations get thrown out, which I think is such a travesty. You know, like in new productions, it's you always get a classic show. You almost always get a new orchestration. And oftentimes, you know, that will come with a new overture or a new sort of imagining of the beginning of the show. Oftentimes they'll throw out the overture altogether. But this one seems to have real lasting power, this overture.
Well, that's how we start the show. And then Act One essentially begins with this song called May We Entertain You, or, you know, occasionally also called Let Me Entertain You. It depends on what version you're looking at, but the same lyrics are there regardless. We were mentioning this before we hit record. It's a little bit of a hard thing to talk about. We are going to still discuss this song, but this show is actually filled with a bunch of songs that are like this show within a show type songs, which are kind of meant to be bad-ish. This one opens up, interestingly enough, being performed not in the best possible way, which is an interesting way to start your show. But, I mean, I think we can kind of figure that out based on context clues and the fiction that this show is creating, that this is not like a finished piece that we are being brought into as an audience.
Yeah, and if I could just say, like, the you know, before we even get into the lyrics, like, here's another example of where the orchestration is part of the storytelling. Because what do you hear when it starts? It's like, it's, you know, you've just heard this huge band with strings and this crazy brass and everything. And then I call it Let Me Entertain You. That starts and you hear like one fiddle and a piano and like a bass and drum, you know? So you know that you're in some rink-a-dink little, you know, vaudeville theater, probably out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, right away it tells you, oh, you know, the band, you know, there's no band anymore. It's just this tiny little ensemble that's the accompaniment to this theater. So, you know, it's funny how the, you know, and often overlooked, I think, how the orchestration can tell you a bit of the story as well.
I think that's such a key thing to hone in on, that what we choose to hear and what like the producers choose to utilize can very much color our interpretations of the show, or really make it feel differently. I have only seen videos of this, but I'd love to go and attend a production of it one day, which is sometimes they do this Sweeney Todd version where each character plays an instrument.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
right. Which is a very much like more subdued version of that show, I think, when you don't have a full orchestra really behind you. Anyways, it's just an interesting way because it has a new feeling behind it, I think, rather than just having it all musicalized from day one.
Yeah, I'll say no more about that.
You not saying anything says everything.
Yeah, I hope it does.
So let me just go through this because this is like, I don't know, eight lines for first edition of May We Entertain You. So we are introduced to the kid versions of June and Louise. And I'm going to apologize because what I normally do is I like to mention the actresses who sing these renditions of the three different versions that we've picked from. I could not find who some of the actresses actually were, so I'm going to skip that for right now. So June starts out in her kind of like babyish girl voice, "May we entertain you?" And then Louise is very quiet and says, "May we see you smile?" And then June says, "I will do some kicks." And there's a nice little like cymbal crash at that point. And then Louise again, fairly quiet, says, "I will do some tricks." And this is when we hear Rose for the very first time in all the versions, because this is usually when she shouts out, "Sing out, Louise, sing out," from like behind us in the theater. And then June says, "I'll tell you a story." And Louise says, "I'll dance when she's done." And then they both come together to say, "By the time we're through entertaining you, you'll have a barrel of fun." So that is our introduction. I have to actually admit to a few different things. This is going to tell you a lot about me. When you mentioned that some people find Ethel Merman Brash, I am one of those people, to be honest. I pretty much enjoy every other version of Ethel Merman shows without Ethel Merman being in them. The second is that I also have, except for very specific instances, there are a bunch of exceptions to this, but by and large, I also am not the biggest enjoyer of children singing. I just don't know what it is, what that is, that hits my ear in the wrong way, but that is my prejudices that I'm laying on the table here right now. What I want to discuss, though, first about this song, because I do want to discuss this in context of how it actually changes throughout the show. But when we first are brought into this, what do you feel as an audience member when you watch this?
Well, I think what you get from it right away is that this is a kid's song, that it's very simple, that it is, you right away you get this dichotomy of the two sisters, right? And so, you know, you see that one is very flamboyant and ostentatious, the little girl, and then you see that her older sister is deeply uncomfortable on stage, and that, you know, her mother is constantly haranguing her, and that she's, you know, involved in this thing that she, you know, really just does not want to be there. So you get all of that storytelling within, you know, just these first few lines. But, you know, you also get a sense of, I mean, it was like what I was saying about the little ensemble before, that this is like, there's something shabby about this. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something that is thrown together. And that, you know, in many ways, this song is just a frame for the talents of the little girl, who gets to do her cartwheels and, you know, her kicks, and, you know, she gets to scream out her little song at the top of her lungs, and that, you know, almost anything could do. Now, we come to find out later, and I know that we're going to talk about this, that this song is actually doing so much more work. But at the very base level, you know, when you first see the show for the first time, there's no real hint of that. And I think that really is the genius of the songwriters, is that this song can read as something, you know, diegetically bad or, you know, old fashioned or shabby.
Well, this is one of the things that I love. And I think I've mentioned it once in one of the episodes during West Side Story. And I know other composers do this, but what I've always loved about Sondheim from day one is that in a lot of his shows, what he likes to do is like bring a theme or even like a phrase sometimes and introduce it in one way. And then later on in the show, bring it back. And now that same line or same musical phrase is like completely different in that context. And when you can pull that off, I just really enjoy that because like, whoa, I was not even thinking about that, but now looking at it this way, singing that same line, it gives that so much more weight and so much more meaning towards it than what it did at the very beginning for me.
Well, if you like that, I've got a 16-hour-long tetralogy of operas by Richard Wagner called The Ring Cycle for you.
Oh, yes. All right.
Because, you know, I mean, that's really like, you know, this is a technique that goes back to opera. And it precedes Wagner, but Wagner is, of course, the big famous advocate of it. Which is this, it's called a leitmotif, a bit of music that is associated with a particular character or thought or idea or place or, you know, prop or anything that is then called back anytime that idea is brought back. And oftentimes, you know, like with Wagner, it turns into this whole sort of matrix, this tapestry of these little motifs, you know, where like when one character is holding this sword, you know, you hear the theme for that character plus the sword. And of course, you know, this got taken up in film scores. I mean, you know, certainly in Lord of the Rings, which is coming out of that whole Wagnerian kind of ethos. But, you know, it's very useful for any storytelling that you're trying to do through music. And, you know, it obviously became very popular on the Broadway stage, you know, and it's funny. I think that in Broadway, it started out really just as reprises, depending on how you'd like to pronounce that word. And this was in many ways just a way to make the tunes stick in people's heads. It didn't really have depth in terms of storytelling. And now it's like, I'm thinking back to say like, you know, this earlier generation that we were talking about, you know, somebody like a Cole Porter, you know, brought back songs later in the show so that they would stick in people's head and they would sell sheet music in the gift shop afterwards, you know, something like that. And then people like, well, I mean, I think you really have to credit somebody like Oscar Hammerstein. The show that I'm thinking of specifically here is Showboat. where, you know, I mean, that's a show where songs really do come back with a dramatic purpose and a different slant on them. So it's no surprise that, you know, Sondheim really soaked that up. But I mean, you know, you see it in West Side Story, you see it in a lot of shows, but Sondheim is a master of it. For sure.
I guess we've discovered what my next podcast will be. It'll just be like a chronological look at the Ring cycle. every leitmotif we'll go through.
You know, you'll get a bunch of crazy people listening to that, just like you'll get a bunch of crazy people listening
That's
to
right.
this. I promise you. Similar rabid level of fandom
for
Wagner as there is for Sondheim.
I just think that it, yeah, opens up here and there's these precocious kids, of course, singing this song. And we're introduced to this overbearing stage mother. And I think that it just sets this dynamic for the entire rest of the show. Without having to necessarily hit us over the heads with it, we kind of get what's going on right from this quick, like, I think in most recordings, it's less than a minute long that this song takes on the recording. So, like, we all get it. We all understand it. Now, it is brought up a couple more times. Specifically, it is in the Baby June and Her Newsboys song, which... we'll discuss a little bit more in a future episode. But I think the biggest one that when it comes back is that there is literally another song that's called Let Me Entertain You
right.
later on in the show. It's called the same thing, which is actually not included inside of the book, Finishing the Hat, that Sondheim writes, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's a curious omission. I agree.
Because there is some slight changes to it. So I've called it up. I'm breaking tradition here, and I am going to go onto the internet to look at these. And I love the internet in many, many ways. But apparently, according to Google, Let Me Entertain You from Gypsy was written by Freddie Mercury. So,
oh my God.
Just so you know, that's canon now. That is what it says, and it has to be true. The character of Louise definitely transforms throughout this show. We first find her in this song as being this shy girl who's very uncomfortable on stage. And the tragedy of this show is that her overbearing stage mother essentially pushes her into becoming a stripper. Then we get this song as she's kind of coming into her own. So in this case, I will say the three actresses who play adult Louise in the original Broadway cast, it's Sandra Church. In the 2003 revival, it's played by Tammy Blanchard. And then Laura Benanti plays the character of Louise in the 2008 revival. As I keep telling people, well, technically not because this is the first episode, but as I will keep telling you people, this is the version I've actually seen on Broadway, is the 2008 revival. It's the only version of Gypsy that I've seen on Broadway. I've listened to all the other ones for sure. So the difference here is that we start off by her saying, let me entertain you, let me see you smile, let me do a few tricks, some old and then some new tricks. I'm very versatile. And if you're real good, I'll make you feel good. I'd want your spirit to climb. So let me entertain you. We'll have a real good time. Yes, sir. We'll have a real good time. In some productions, what I love about this song is that you actually hear the transformation happening where she, again, starts off shy and you kind of hear Rose prodding her to go along and she slowly becomes more and more comfortable as time goes on, as it segues into some more of the choruses here. But what do you think about these? I mean, it's using some of the same language, but now it's getting a bit perverted, for lack of a better term.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have a lot to say about this. One thing is that, you know, I love it when you hear that in the production of her transformation sort of happening in condensed time, you know, real time in terms of the song and yet condensed time in terms of the, you know, her growing more and more comfortable with this idea of the striptease. And again, I think that's a case of where the music is telling the story and specifically the orchestration is once again telling the story. Because the orchestra sort of, you know, it changes from being threadbare to being, you know, full throttled, like burlesque style music, you know, that we sort of got in the overture. You know, the other thing I'll say is that, like, I don't know, in terms of my familiarity with this song and this show, we were talking about this, how like it, like I think of the opening song as Let Me Entertain You as well.
Sure.
You know, and like the way that I know it is that there is a little bit more overlap in terms of the language. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I think is being the real genius of this song, is that it is convincingly innocent the first time you hear it, and it's convincingly filthy when it comes back and it's being recontextualized in the burlesque show. And that is really, I think it's doing a lot of work, this song, you know? And the first time you hear it, it goes in one ear, one out the other. I mean, it just sounds like 100 other, you know, Julie Stein trunk tunes. But really, it's like, you know, there's something very clever going on here. And apparently this is what I was shocked when I was reading up on this, that was not the original intention. You know, so like there were supposed to be two different songs. There was going to be a song for the kids, and there was going to be a song for Louise when she, you know, turns into Gypsy Rose Lee. And then Sondheim was like, oh, wait a second, I could just save myself the trouble and use the same song. And it's like, you know, that's a much harder thing in the end, but it works dramatically so incredibly well. And yeah. Then, you know, there is the other one iteration of this song, which is it comes back. I'm sure you'll do a whole episode about if Mama Was Married. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's in there, you know, if Mama Was Married, there wouldn't be any more. Let me entertain you. Let me make you smile.
If Mama Was Married, there wouldn't be any more. Let me entertain you. Let me make you smile. I will do some kicks.
So it's like now they're more grown up. And they're sort of like, you get this perspective that they know that what they're doing is totally hokey, and that, you know, it's just like it's being used as a plot point to show how put upon these two girls are. And they're referencing back to, you know, it's to them having to put on a show. You know, I mean, it's like it's the perfect stand in for that concept.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing that I'm taking away from this, I mean, it's kind of saying similar things than what we've already discussed, but I just want to nail it right down. The first time we hear a rendition of this song, it's almost like it almost feels like a nursery rhyme, like "May we entertain you." Like it has this like lilting, like upbeat scale here, and then once we get to this song, especially near the end of it, it's almost like through gritted teeth, like and sexualizing, like there's this like, oh my gosh. To me, it feels honestly. It's a slightly different thing, but you see this a lot in horror films when they do a similar thing where they have like a little kid reciting a nursery rhyme like slowly.
And then
echo, and like, well, that's creepy because you're recontextualizing what's supposed to be.
You hear the little calliope or something.
Yeah.
The music from like the merry-go-rounders. So, yeah, there's nothing creepier.
Right. It's like, I want ice cream, but I'm terrified at the same time. It recontextualizes it to a point where it's like, oh, I'm off put by this now. And in this, you see, you use that song. It's like, oh, this is supposed to be like this children's like upbeat song. And we have now completely gone anti-ethical to what this is supposed to be about.
Right. It's a real perversion.
Yeah. A lot of the next part of this is spoken. So I'll read through this, which is, hello, everybody. My name is Gypsy Rose Lee. What's yours, Mr. Conductor? If you please. So let me entertain you and we'll have a real good time. Yes, sir. We'll have a real good time. And then it goes to this entire like lengthy description that, you know, I'm not going to read through the entire thing, but I like this part about her talking to this guy in the audience, which is like, some men accuse me of being an ecdysiast. Do you know what that means? Do you? Oh, you do. He's embarrassed. Don't be embarrassed. I like men without hair. An ecdysiast is one who or that which sheds its skin. In vulgar parlance, a stripper. But I'm not a stripper. At these prices, I'm an ecdysiast. And then goes into its final thing.
At these prices, I'm an ecdysiast! And if you're real good, I'll make you feel.
I think this is a good time to just briefly discuss, which again, we'll probably expand upon this in future episodes, is this idea of vaudeville, right? Because vaudeville was all about this melding of like talents. It would be like a sometimes more of an X-rated version of like America's Got Talent, I would say, which is you could have someone juggling and then someone like coming and singing a song. And then maybe you would have something that was a little bit vulgar. And then we'd have some comedians that would come on. So there was like just this like variety show that was going around all the different like vaudeville theaters around the U.S. And
right. But it's important not to conflate vaudeville necessarily with a with burlesque.
With burlesque, yeah, which, you're right.
And the meaning of both things did change over the course of time. So I think that vaudeville, when it started, really was like a variety show, and it was much more family entertainment. Mm-hmm. You know, where you would have these little kids act, and that would be perfectly, you know, part of it. But of course, vaudeville experienced a big decline during the 1920s and 30s because of the rise of movies. So in order to compete with movies, vaudeville then had to transform to something else, and it brought in what were called burlesque acts. So I mean, this show really does chart the course of the transformation of vaudeville to burlesque. And it, you know, once again, the meaning of burlesque changed over the years as well. I mean, originally, a burlesque was sort of like a spoof. It was a farce. It was like you could burlesque Shakespeare's Hamlet. You know, you could do a spoof version of it with sort of, you know, gags and turn it into, you know, a comedy somehow. But then, the meaning of burlesque changed to be this more striptease adult entertainment. And then that also became conflated with vaudeville in the 1940s and 50s, because just in order to stay as viable, you know, houses of entertainment, those vaudeville theaters had to really lower their standards in terms of the kind of raciness of the acts that they would put on stage.
Yeah. How does the Follies fit into that? Like, how does Ziegfeld and all that kind of stuff fit into burlesque, fit into vaudeville?
That's vaudeville. I mean, that's high vaudeville, I would say. And, that version of it, I think, got absorbed more into Broadway theater. You know, that, I mean, that, because that was happening in New York, the Ziegfeld stuff. You know, I guess Ziegfeld probably had some theaters throughout the North America, but I mean, it was mainly a New York thing. And most of those performers came from operetta. You know, they were often doing stuff like Sig Romberg shows or Gilbert and Sullivan, and then they more morphed into the early, 1920s shows of Cole Porter and Victor Herbert. But, you know, it was the vaudeville houses out in the sticks that, you know, really had to compete against the Nickelodeon cinemas, and they took a turn for the worse.
Yeah, all that stuff kind of eventually evaporated away, unfortunately.
Right.
I love seeing the history of that, or like seeing even movies set around that time period, because there's always these rose-tinted glasses we think about going back, like making it big on vaudeville or in the early stages. Like, it would have been a rough gig, I think. It probably would not have been that fun of a time.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, that's a trunk show. I mean, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you take the whole show with you in a trunk. You know, all of your costumes, all of your props, everything, and you just have to have a self-contained act. And, you know, you're riding the rails, you know, you're probably just staying at really lousy, you know, kind of boarding houses along the way, and, you know, not eating well and not taking care of yourself, and who knows what's going on backstage. But yeah, I mean, I think it was probably a really rough way to make your living. But, you know, yeah, people are attracted to show business. They'll do whatever it takes.
It's true. Unfortunately, sometimes. I think it does show the difference of the generations, though. And maybe a little bit about that, friction is too strong of a word, but that difference of styles between Sondheim and Julie Stein. Not that Julie Stein was coming up around vaudeville necessarily. The idea that, hey, I got an act and I do this act, and I never change it. Like, it's just what works is what works, and I have that act. Versus probably a philosophy like, change it every so often. We're slightly changing it, or I want to write based on character and motivation and where they are in the show and mentally what's happening to them. Whereas another way to do it is like just write a song. You just put some words to a melody, and there you have a song.
Right, and throw those songs together, and you know, lo and behold, you have a show. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's clear that Sondheim has an affection for this style and this mm-hmm. era. I mean, because you know, and it's really interesting that he had, you know, through because he was so young when he started, and he was working with a lot of people who were much more mature than he was. You know, he had this authentic connection to this older brand of musical theater, and it's so cool to hear him, you know, then write his own sort of pastiche vaudeville numbers, you know, like you were saying, when it comes to Follies.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, I have a feeling that doing this show was probably a great training ground, or you know, maybe it was gearing his mind in that direction for when he would come upon Follies, you know, however many years later it was, 10 years later or whatever.
So we end off by here kind of singing the chorus, which is, "And if you're real good, I'll make you feel good. I want your spirit to climb. Let me entertain you, and we'll have a real good time. Yes, sir, we'll have a real good time." I know what it is. I've now said this phrase like three times, and you're so right in saying when the kids sing it, it doesn't feel weird or gross. And yet, as soon as she says, "I want your spirit to climb," and it's when singing it in this connotation, it's just like, ugh, gross.
Yeah, it's amazing, and that really is what's impressive about this song. And like I say, you know, I really am used to hearing the little girl sing, "Let me entertain you," and to having a lot more of those lines, you know, sure. "And if you're real good, I'll make you feel good." But I guess that they revised it for a later version, and that's what Sondheim puts in the book. But I think it works really well, you know, when it's basically the identical song, mm-hmm. just sung in two totally different guises.
Right. And again, underscores what we just kind of discussed, right? It's like someone gets an act or a song and they just re-sing it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Even in this weird context, like I'm just singing the same song again, which I think kind of maybe underscores the show a little bit about as horrified as maybe we as an audience and even Rose is that this is where her daughter has ended up. She's still in show business. We got to show business eventually, and we're still kind of just making, utilizing that same old song over and over again.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's in many ways, this show is a real tragedy.
Yeah, I know. Well, hopefully I don't become an ecdysiast anytime soon, but I guess don't hold your breath. Well, thank you so much for joining me here today. This was a really good conversation. If people wanted to stay in contact or find you online, how could they do that?
I'm Will C. White everywhere. WILLCWHITE. I'm Will at Will C. White on Twitter. My personal webpage is willcwhite.com. I have YouTube sites, you know, so yeah, that's where they can find me. And if I can just get one last mm-hmm. plug here at the end, which is that one bit of follow-up from West Side Story, you use those three recordings, which are all great. Uh-huh. There is a very recent recording that Michael Tilson Thomas, who's the conductor of the San Francisco Symphony, made of the full score of West Side Story. And of course, he was one of Leonard Bernstein's main proteges. And certainly in terms of the orchestral playing, I don't think there's a better rendition. So it probably came out in 2016 or 17.
Is there singing on it, or is it just the orchestra?
Oh yeah. It's a whole recording of the show. I mean, yeah, there's it's a very good cast. You know, so I mean, it's not, it strikes a nice ground between that sort of terrible version that Bernstein did himself in you know, the mid-80s with the opera singers.
Yeah.
But so it is a little bit more note perfect than some of the, you know, the 1960s versions, but I think it captures the authentic spirit of what it's going for. So I don't know, just if people are looking for another recording, I would recommend that one pretty highly.
I'll link to it in the description of this episode for sure, just so that people can check that out. As we continue to say, West Side Story is having this bit of a renaissance because new movie, new Broadway production.
Right.
Although having said that, it seems like Gypsy is rebooted like every 5 years or so. So I'm sure another revival is probably going to be coming out fairly soon for Gypsy too, because it seems like it needs to constantly be relooked at again. But Will, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Kyle.
Thanks for listening. I truly appreciate it. Thanks to the Alberta Podcast Network, to ATB, and to Let's Do Coffee this week. If you have additional feedback, comments, questions, or a great guest idea, please send that to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. I think I need to figure out a way to jazz up these end credits. What are your suggestions? Thank you to Terrence for being one of our Playbill level patrons. Also, a big thanks to the always great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. Well, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now. As an outside observer, what do you think Cats is about? If you just had to guess, like, what the plot line was.
I assume it's about a bunch of dirty old cats that are in the alleyway, and they're like, ooh, we hate this snowball cat, you know, something like that.
You're not that wrong, to be honest. You got it pretty much nailed.